Russia is hoping that Azerbaijan and Armenia will adhere to a ceasefire it has helped negotiate following the deadly flare-up at the border. President Putin doubles down on Russia's resolve to move its economy away from the US dollar. And police in the UK are facing criticism for the arrest of anti-royalist protesters following the new king's accession to the throne. Hello and welcome to World News. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour, a ceasefire is holding after deadly clashes erupted between Armenia and Azerbaijan on Monday night over the disputed border. Both sides agreed to stop exchange of fire this morning under a Russian brokered truce. Moscow now says it remains extremely concerned and hopes the ceasefire holds. Both Baku and Yerevan accused one another for their flare-up. They both also reported casualties. Azerbaijan is yet to offer the details, with Armenia putting its death toll at 49. Meanwhile, Iran's president has called any new war unacceptable. Ebrahim Raisi said in a phone call with Armenia's Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan that Iran is closely watching the developments. Raisi called for a negotiated settlement to the tensions. Armenia and Azerbaijan have fought several battles since the 2020 war over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. President of the Asia Institute, Emmanuel Pastrich, earlier told us about the possible role Iran can play to end the conflict.
Iran and Turkey can play. I mean, Turkey has, I think, not played such a positive role so far. Iran, in a way, has greater trust with Armenia and has, of course, the cultural ties with Azerbaijan that could make all the difference. The war before, what's really changed is in the Nagorno-Karabakh region, the previous conflict in the 1990s and really until recently, Russia has been neutral, has tried to stay out, whereas now I think Russia really has no choice if NATO is trying to muscle in and get control of oil and gas there, then these interests overwhelm all the smaller ones. And sadly, geopolitical conflicts can overwhelm the interests of the particular countries involved. That's why we really need a country, perhaps Iran, perhaps others, who are willing to try and step back from this escalating conflict between Russia and NATO and try and get back to talking about people, talking about long-term interests.
Russia's president says it's inevitable for the global economy to replace the U.S. dollar with other currencies in its transactions. Vladimir Putin says his country is doing well despite what he called external financial and technological aggression. He was referring to the sanctions Western countries have imposed on Russia of the war in Ukraine. Putin added that Russia managed to stabilize inflation and prevent a sharp decline in the economy despite the bans. Moscow has been pushing a de-dollarization strategy over the past months. It is a reaction to the U.S. cutting off Russia's central bank from the dollars. Moving on to the war between Moscow and Kiev. The Ukrainian army claims it has retaken 500 square kilometers of territory from Russian forces in the south of the country in the past 2 weeks. The army says it has taken full control over several settlements in the Kherson region. Ukraine has also been claiming gains against the Russian military in the east. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said his country's forces had recaptured 6,000 square kilometers of territory from Russia this month. Meanwhile, the Kremlin has reiterated that it will achieve its goals of a military operation that it launched in Ukraine back in February. Germany is drawing out draft legislation to provide federal credit assistance to energy companies battered by the energy row with Russia. Germany media cited government officials as saying that Berlin wants to offer guarantees and liquidity assistance to energy firms. This will include credit authorizations of nearly $60 billion Several European energy firms have requested state support to stay afloat after Russia halted natural gas exports to Europe last week. The latest is German utility EnBW that announced a $560 million loss on Monday. Moscow says the gas flow won't resume until Western sanctions over the war in Ukraine are removed. The US is hit by its largest ever strike of private sector nurses as some 15,000 healthcare workers join a walkout across Minnesota. The nurses are protesting hospital understaffing and demanding higher wages. The strike is scheduled to last 3 days and will affect 16 hospitals. Negotiations have been ongoing for more than 5 months without reaching an agreement. The strike spotlights nationwide nursing shortages exacerbated by the coronavirus pandemic. This has not only put a heavy strain on workers, but also led to patients not receiving adequate care. Strikes in the U.S. have occurred regularly over the past year, and employees are reporting to be exhausted by working during the COVID-19 pandemic and struggling with price rises. Civil liberties groups slam British police crackdown on anti-monarchy protesters. During the ceremonies to mark the death of Queen Elizabeth, the advocacy group Liberty says it is deeply concerned by the powers given to the police to curb acts of protest. The Global Majority Versus campaign has also condemned what it called centuries of colonial injustice and genocide in the name of the British Crown. Others are saying that calling for abolition of the monarchy is not a crime. This comes after arrests of several anti-monarchy protesters as royals attended rituals, including in Edinburgh. Earlier, the main anti-monarch group Republic said support for ending the institution and debate its relevance in the UK has grown since the death of the Queen on Thursday. Earlier, political analyst Syed Mohsen Abbas gave us his perspective on the British police response to anti-monarchy protests.
Even people as kind of benign as protesters against the monarchy are being called up on the streets. And of course, this is indicative of where a lot of the direction of Western actual democracy, so-called democracies, are. They're basically going through a transition where a lot of the old rights just won't be there. I mean, they're being eroded slowly but steadily. It'll be very interesting to see how King Charles III deals with any such matters. They do raise the fact that through the Republic, who you quoted earlier, they often raise the fact that the monarchy actually costs Britain around £345 million a year. Their well-wishers would argue that the royal family also attracts tourists and is part of a tourist industry, which also gives Britain something.
On a related note, more Commonwealth countries are asking whether they should keep or ditch the Queen's successor as the head of state. New Zealand's Prime Minister says she supports the idea of shifting the country to a republic, adding that this is something which will eventually take place. Jacinda Ardern, however, says a transition would take time. Her Australian counterpart Anthony Albanese has not ruled out a referendum on a republic if he is re-elected in 2025. His government also says it's considering replacing the image of the Queen on banknotes with Australian figures.
The priority for us is ensuring a smooth transition of the coins. As I understand it, the decision to include the Queen's face in the $5 note was about her personally rather than about her status as a monarch. So that transition isn't automatic. We'll have a sensible conversation within government and make an appropriate announcement in due course.
Apart from New Zealand and Australia, calls to ditch the British monarchy are also growing in other Commonwealth nations. Antigua and Barbuda says the island country will hold a referendum on transitioning to a republic in 3 years. Jamaica has also said it's considering independence. The death of Queen Elizabeth II has brought renewed focus on the British royal family's life of privilege and affluence at a time when millions of Britons are struggling to get by in the face of record economic uncertainty and a deepening energy crisis. From London, Said Pourreza reports.
Public expressions of grief for the death of the Queen by those who see the royals as a glamorous family contributing millions of dollars into the UK economy each year, for instance, in tourism revenues. But that sentiment seems to be changing with growing calls for Britain to become a republic. The reasons for that transformation vary, but one argument used on both sides of the divide is money, taxpayer money, more than $130 million of it, granted by the British government to the royal family, covering their official parties, travels, security, and upkeep of their palaces, funds that anti-monarchists say could be spent on more urgent matters.
So why, for a family that already has so many riches, why don't they pay for that? You know, why does that come out of the public pocket? Because especially in this time where we need public funds for the cost of living crisis, I mean, we've got so many underfunded public services here.
I don't think it sets a good precedent for the way, like, taxpayers' money is spent. Give it to the NHS.
The National Public Service is not the only area that needs help. There's the deepening cost of living crisis, driven by soaring energy costs and an economy on the brink of recession.
People are going to suffer fuel poverty over this winter, and that without intervention of a fairly drastic nature, people are going to have to decide whether to heat their homes or to eat. Now, this seems a total obscenity in a nation which is one of the G6.
The British monarchy has an estimated wealth of more than $90 billion and privileges not available to the rest of the public.
We have Prince Charles, who is about to inherit the world's wealthiest woman's entire portfolio without an inheritance tax. That is a loss of literally hundreds of millions to the exchequer.
The past few months have seen multiple public sector strikes, mostly over pay, to keep up with the soaring cost of living that's pushing millions of people into poverty. It remains to be seen if the House of Windsor will continue to live on the public dime, and if so, what will the public do about it? Cyprus is up, London.
Israel has launched a massive campaign of arrests in the occupied West Bank, detaining dozens of Palestinians since Sunday. The arrests have been made during raids in the cities of Jenin and Al-Khalil. Mona Khandil has more from Ramallah.
As part of Israel's months-long so-called Operation Break the Wave, regime forces have arrested dozens of Palestinians during raids across the occupied West Bank since Sunday. This time, the regime intensified its arrest campaign in the cities of Jenin and Al-Khalil. Israeli military issued a statement saying those who were detained are terrorist suspects. The regime conducts night raids in response to a series of anti-Israel operations that led to the killing of 19 Israeli soldiers and settlers earlier this year.
Whatever the Israeli military names its operations, these raids by the Israeli forces as well as by the settlers are an open war against the Palestinian people. The raids are an attempt to break the Palestinians' will to force them to abandon all forms of resistance and to stop fighting for their freedom.
The arrest campaign comes amid aggressive policies practiced by the Israeli prison authorities against thousands of Palestinian prisoners languishing behind Israeli bars. Cancer-stricken prisoner Nasser Abu Hamid, the leader of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades in Ramallah, is in a life-threatening health condition after he fell into a coma. The Palestinian Prisoner Society has warned Abu Hamid is fighting for his life as the Israeli prison service continues to refuse to provide him with necessary medical care. Abu Hamid has been in jail since 2002, serving a life sentence.
We call on all Palestinian groups to mobilize people and hold rallies to express their anger and rejection of the Israeli criminal policies that have led to the deaths of many of Palestinian prisoners. Nasser Abu Hamid is a national hero and a symbol for the Palestinian people. He is literally battling for his life due to his worsening health condition.
According to the Palestinian Prisoners Society, 231 prisoners have died in Israeli jails since 1967.
So on the one hand, detention of Palestinians is on the rise, and on the other hand, torturing and denying prisoners basic human rights is also on the rise. Israel claims these policies are meant to mow the lawn, prevent any forms of resistance, but for Palestinians, these illegal policies are part of Tel Aviv's perpetual war against them. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says Palestinians will continue their struggle until they take back their rights and drive the occupiers out of their ancestral land. The group, in a statement, also highlighted the legitimacy of the Palestinians' resistance against Israeli atrocities. The statement was issued on the 17th anniversary marking the regime's expulsion from the Gaza Strip. It also condemned Israel's cruel siege of the coastal strip and stressed that the Palestinian nation would not remain silent on the continued blockade. In 2005, Israel withdrew its forces from Gaza in what it called a separation plan. The regime, however, imposed a crippling blockade on the strip, potentially turning it into an open prison for nearly a million Palestinians. Gazans have repeatedly called on the international community to push for an end to the inhumane siege. Russia says Iran's latest response to the EU's draft text for the revival of the 2015 deal constitutes no serious obstacle to a final agreement. In a tweet, Moscow's envoy to the talks said, "The conclusion of the talks depends exclusively on the political will of the participating states." Iran and the US have been corresponding indirectly over the EU proposal. The US claims that Iran's reply was not constructive, while the EU says diverging Tehran-Washington positions have put the revival of the deal in danger. On Monday, Germany's Chancellor Olaf Scholz alleged that Iran has not yet responded positively to the draft. Tehran, however, says it has not asked for any new demands or raised any new issues that could be an obstacle to the agreement. Iran and other signatories to the deal, formerly known as the JCPOA, are now awaiting a formal US response. Washington left the deal in 2018. Iraqi border officials say over 3 million pilgrims have so far entered the country for the annual commemoration of Arba'in. Officials say the flow of pilgrims traveling to the country is very smooth. Every year, millions of people, many of them from Iran, walk toward the city of Karbala, which hosts the shrine of Imam Hussein. That's to mark 40 days since the Imam's martyrdom anniversary. Karbala's governor says they expect over 20 million pilgrims to visit the province this year. The pilgrimage, which is one of the largest religious congregations in the world, reaches its peak on the day of Arba'in on September 17th this year. Well, those were the top stories for this hour. Thank you for joining us.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
insight.
Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing the war in Ukraine with TV correspondent Johnny Miller. But first, this brief analysis.
It is said that the first victim of war is the truth. And this seems to be especially the case as it relates to the war in Ukraine. Very rarely have the global consumers of Western media been subjected to such a high level of propaganda, ridiculously pro-Ukrainian and viciously anti-Russian, in line with NATO objectives. Western news outlets have taken upon themselves to basically be the public relations arm of NATO. The level of public shaming and gaslighting of experts, academics, and journalists in the media is so intense that there are virtually no Western politicians courageous enough to publicly disagree with the warmongering and hype, not to mention the fact that right at the beginning of the war, all Russian media were banned in the West by the Western champions of liberal democracy and free speech, lest the so-called wrong facts get transmitted to Western citizens and mess up NATO's plans for a long, attritional war with Russia. In this environment, Press TV has tried to conduct fair reporting by reporting the facts from both sides, some of which expose the lies and false narratives being propagated by Western media in their zeal to be of service to Western military and security organizations. Press TV correspondent Johnny Miller reported the facts as he saw it, including crimes committed by the neo-Nazi elements of the Ukrainian military, as well as reports that paint a somewhat different picture of the mood and morale among Ukrainian civilians than the rosy caricature often portrayed in Western media. Johnny Miller's reward for his excellent journalistic effort is that he was placed on a so-called kill list of Ukrainian neo-Nazis, which includes personal information and encourages people to murder the people on the list, an Italian journalist already falling victim to this outrage. The evil combination of neo-Nazi fanatics being sponsored by the suit and tie-wearing terrorists of NATO make it very difficult to discuss and possibly find a peaceful solution to this devastating war. The comedian president of Ukraine seems to have realized that there will not be a military victory in the cards for Ukraine against Russia. But he might also be in too deep with his neo-Nazi NATO cabal to be able to do anything other than what he's ordered to do. Otherwise, he too might one day end up on the Ukrainian neo-Nazi kill list.
Johnny Miller, thank you for joining us on Insight. I want to spend our time today talking about the war in Ukraine. As you know, our program, we try to look at the historic, the strategic context of the news that we witness on a daily basis, something that unfortunately is no longer there in Western media, in mainstream media. But before we get to that, you know, the rule in journalism is that the journalist should never himself or herself become the story. But unfortunately, it seems that some people don't play by those rules. And it seems, unfortunately, that they put your name on this so-called kill list. It's even nasty to even say it, but unfortunately, that seems to be what has happened. We shouldn't act like nations don't have their own national interests. We shouldn't act like because there was European integration, because there is this kind of solidarity within the Western countries, that somehow, you know, whatever is in America's interest is also in Germany's interest, or whatever is in America's interest is also in Sweden or Britain's interest. Of course, you said, you know, I'm going to out myself as a Scottish nationalist, so I would say the Scots don't have to worry about the oil. They have enough oil and gas for themselves. But a place like Germany, obviously, is a major problem if they can't have normal relations with Russia, because their entire industry, it's not only oil and gas, it's aluminum, it's various raw materials that are the basis of this mighty German, you know, industrial system that exists there. So yeah, I think maybe the story, and this is good when we have these kind of conversations, we get to some new insight, which is the point of our program, is that maybe, like you said, this is going to have a much more devastating effect on these Western European countries who are, and again, I think we should distinguish between the people and the elites. I think most people in Europe are keenly aware of that this is just wrong. Yes, they might not, they don't agree with Russian invasion. They sympathize with the Ukrainian people. It's not that they are on the Russian side, but they realize that it is not in their interest to become this kind of, you know, cannon fodder for NATO or America's, you know, imperial plans or strategic plans.
I don't know about that. I mean, I'll tell you when I go back to London. I haven't been there for a while. But before I went, I mean, there seems to be the propaganda. Noam Chomsky and John Pilger said a couple of weeks ago that since the Vietnam War, all these years they've been important, they've never seen the propaganda like in this war, in any else. And I think it's largely working. I mean, I'll get back to you when I get back to London, but there seems to be, as I said, no serious debate about NATO's involvement of this whitewashing of the extremists. And I expect this propaganda is having a huge effect. I mean, now Ukraine is largely off the news, I think. It was big for the first month. Now it's largely off. So I wonder, actually, just how many people know much about Ukraine. But I think what you will see, of course, is the further gas prices go up and food prices go up, and the further that's linked to Ukraine, which is a big part of why they're going up, then, of course, I think people, for their own self-interest, might start to wonder, why are we in Ukraine? And then you may well see more reporting about the kind of stuff that I'm reporting on. If you see policy-making change, you may well see some of the journalists being sent to East Ukraine and Donbass and starting to tell the whole story. Well, you know, maybe there are some pro-Russian people there, or maybe there are some extremists. Maybe we shouldn't be sending weapons. Maybe we should push for peace. So you might see the media narrative change if you see the policy, government policy change.
Well, you know, I think this is an interesting thing we can speculate about, which is that there's a desperate attempt, it seems to me, by NATO, which is basically an American military organization. I mean, it's true, it has all these different countries that are in it, but everybody knows that it's, you know, basically America's military coalition, that it can command to do whatever it wants. It seems to me that the defeat in Afghanistan was really something that was an existential problem for these people. They had come in and said that, you know, NATO is going to be, Afghanistan is going to be the great project that proves that NATO is still relevant after the Cold War, after the demise of the Soviet Union. And after 20 years, you know, it was just shambles. It was just a mess, as we all remember the way that they fled from Kabul. And it seems to me, and, you know, I think I have reason to be cynical and not have a good view of Western elites and not be optimistic about that they want good for themselves and for their own people, based on what we've seen from them. I think there was an idea that, hey, you know what, we're going to revive NATO here. We're going to give it a new sort of life. We're going to try to, you know, make it relevant and keep it relevant. Maybe bring in some new people. You know, you got Sweden and Russia, Sweden and Finland talking about doing these things, which is very strange. Sweden and Finland were historically always neutral. Even during the Cold War, they were not part of NATO, which was probably more threatening than we have today. You know, Russia, it's very unlikely Russia is going to attack Finland or Sweden. I mean, it's almost, you know, it's virtually impossible that they would do that. So I think we can't underestimate the level to which they're going to desperately try to keep this going, even if the people in the West don't want it to go on. We saw it with the Iraq War.
I think you're right with the difference between the elites and the people. We're seeing that in many examples of it. Increasingly, elites just don't seem to care about the people's living standards. So they may well care more about this grand policy. There's one of the propaganda debates about in this war has been what have Russia's aims been? The West likes to say that Russia tried to take Kiev, failed, so it's this great big victory from Ukraine. I was in Kiev at the start of the war.
Please tell us about it.
So the Russian troops were surrounded Kiev, not entirely surrounded. They allowed people to get in and out through a train route. But there was hardly any strikes, maybe four or five strikes. If you're going to try to take Kiev,
It's clear that Russia's aims are to take over the pro-Russian areas of Ukraine. I think Russia may well have learned their lesson from the Afghanistan in the 90s, or indeed the Americans in Afghanistan. The Americans were in Afghanistan for 20 years, and now who's back in power? The Taliban. It's very hard for a country to rule or take over a country when you have a hostile population. Russia is trying to take over the Donbass region, the southern region, Crimea, of course, annexed 8 years ago. And right. The vast majority of people in Crimea are Russian, so they've had no internal problems.
Yeah, I mean, Khrushchev, who was Ukrainian, gave it to the Ukraine during his rule in the Soviet Union.
Sure. Donbass is the vast majority Russian, so where I was in Donbass, Russia doesn't have any problems controlling those territories. In the southern region, just above Crimea, that's more complicated. Right. Russia's taken that area in order to safeguard Crimea. Crimea, of course, crucial for their geopolitics. They can control Absolutely. The Black Sea from there, which is very important to them. I was in that area. There it's a lot more mixed. I went to the streets. I interviewed a dozen groups of people. About 25% of those people, I'd say, were openly pro-Russian. 25% were openly pro-Ukrainian, although some of them asking to see my British press credentials before answering because they're worried about the authorities. Right. But interesting, about 50% of the people said they've got Russian family, Ukrainian family, and they just want peace.
Right.
Now, since the Russians took over that area, you may well have seen more Ukrainians leave, mm-hmm. And so it's become more of a pro-Russian area. But there's also terrorist attacks or insurgent attacks by Ukrainians, so it's much more mixed. If Russia was to take over the rest of Kiev or the Western Kiev, it would be very hard for them to control that in
Absolutely.
The long term. Just that
Absolutely.
Afghanistan's found out in the Americans found out in Afghanistan. Very hard for them to do that with a hostile population. And so it's not Russia's desire to do that. But my fear is that the Americans may well want that to happen. They want to drag Russia into a long war here. So if you keep arming Ukraine, Russia's, and it's openly said it's going to have to go further. And so that's why you might see this war drag on for years, mm-hmm. rather than anybody suing for peace. For a long-term NATO strategy to try and drag Russia into a new Afghanistan, if you will. Russia's invasion of Afghanistan in the 80s is largely attributed to bring down the Soviet Union. I think that's what NATO's plan is here as well, to bring Russia in to a new Afghanistan. And that's why Russia wants to keep to the pro-Russian areas, but they may well be forced to go further by NATO.
So you don't see any signs within Ukraine, I'm talking about the Ukrainian side, not the Russian speakers or the ethnic Russians, on the Ukrainian side of them wanting to somehow get to a peace agreement or some sort of end of hostilities.
So the Russian side or the Ukrainian
side? The Ukrainian side.
On the Ukrainian side, I think the people, once again, you ask the people. I'd be fascinated if you did a referendum in Ukraine today, either including the pro-Russian areas or not including the pro-Russian areas. If you did a referendum in Ukraine before the Russian invasion started, you asked the Ukrainian people, would you be happy to give away Crimea and Donbass, or there's going to be a Russian invasion? I think we'd be very interested in the answer to that. I think most people in Ukraine, this I'm just speculating, but mm-hmm. I do have some contacts there. For Crimea and Donbass, pro-Russian areas, you know, most Ukrainians, as long as they're not ultra-nationalists, would say, let's just let them have that. But then you've got this area above Crimea, which is more complicated. Many Ukrainians saying, well, we give them Crimea and Donbass, but what about this area, Kherson, for example,
right.
which may well have been majority Ukrainian before Russia got involved. So that's when it becomes a lot more complicated. But if you ask the Ukrainian people now, do you want to negotiate for peace, even if it means ceding territory? I think the majority, I think, would say yes. But that's why you have the government and the nationalists who are very much pushing for. I mean, as a journalist here in Ukraine, I spend a lot of time on the Telegram channels. Okay, that's the new sort of way of journalism. You have to spend a lot of time on the Telegram channels of soldiers and civilians posting videos from the front lines or posting videos of what's going on the streets of West Ukraine. I can't tell you how many videos I saw of conscription officers of the Ukrainian military going into beaches, going on the streets, literally chasing Ukrainian citizens to hand them out conscription notices. You have the old men of military age, 18 to 60, are not allowed to leave the country. They're effectively prisoners in the country and increasingly being forced
to fight. And when they do join up, they've hardly got any military experience, being sent to the front line with almost no weapons. Once again, I can't tell you how many videos I've seen of Ukrainian soldiers with their whole company behind them, reading out a statement to President Zelensky saying, you sent us here with no weapons, we don't want to fight, we refuse to fight, we're going home, essentially. I can't tell you how many videos I've seen of that. You're not seeing any of that in Western media, by the way.
Yeah, very interesting. None of that is in Western media. It's all this kind of propaganda, you know.
It's incredible. I did one story about it, I think, but I can't say how many videos I've seen. And these are Ukrainians posting it, so it's not propaganda. These are Ukrainian soldiers posting these videos to President Zelensky, and I've seen countless numbers of them. And the Western media just says Ukraine morale is sky high. It's not sky high. It may be sky high amongst some of the nationalists or the people at the back, but against and it's poor people who are sent to these front lines mainly, forced to fight, sent to the front lines, and hundreds at one stage, I'm not sure about the numbers now, one stage hundreds were dying every day under Russian artillery. It's an absolute slaughter. This is mainly a proxy war now. So Ukrainian people are being used as cannon fodder for an American proxy war in Ukraine. And it's shocking. And so many people still in the West say, stand for Ukraine. Well, standing for Ukraine, continuing to send them weapons, is literally sending them in to die. And I can't believe how there's not more people pushing for a peaceful negotiated settlement. And one of the reasons there's not is because of the level of propaganda. And also the propaganda making Russia out to be evil people, not just evil government, but evil people. Absolutely. They must be stopped. They're going to invade Eastern Europe. Russia's not going to invade Eastern Europe unless it's pushed to. It's trying to take over Crimea because that's what's important to them and throw Russian areas. But the level of propaganda in order to keep sending money to Ukraine so more Ukrainians die, it's shocking.
Okay, Johnny, so let's talk about the future a little bit, because, I mean, it's pretty bleak what's going on right now, both in terms of what's happening in the Ukraine and the areas where there's conflict, but also, as we were talking, also what's happening to the public in Western Europe and the political and the social environment that we have, this kind of, you know, suffocating, you know, propaganda. So let's try to look to the future a little bit. So let's start with what you were just talking about, which is the idea that maybe it's not sustainable for the Ukrainians to continue much longer. And, you know, everything I've seen from the Russian side points to the fact that they are willing to compromise if they can get, you know, in terms of having the independence of those Donbass republics and Crimea. So if you could give us a little insight on that.
I think, first of all, I don't think Russia's interested in negotiations at the moment either, because essentially if NATO continues to send them weapons, increasingly very high-tech, high-powered weapons that can hit Donetsk or hit Crimea, then Russia doesn't really see a point in negotiating. It's said clearly that if NATO keeps sending these weapons and threatening our cities, we're just going to have to take more of Ukraine. You've got the major cities of Kharkiv and Odessa. I've asked frequently Russian journalists or politicians, do they want to take these cities? Kharkiv and Odessa do have large Russian minorities in them. So if they were to take these cities, with the amount of Ukrainians that flee, they could well be able to control them in the long term. It wouldn't be like Kiev, where the overwhelming population is hostile. So they might want to take these cities as well. But if NATO continues to send weapons to Ukraine, I think Russia will just continue to fight. And maybe that's NATO's aim. Do NATO politicians really care about the death of Ukrainian people or the destruction of Ukrainian cities? If there were hundreds of British or American soldiers dying every single day in Ukraine, you'd have absolute outcry about it. But there's no outcry in Britain because they're Ukrainians. It doesn't really matter to them.
Well, do you think the Ukrainian government can sustain it? I mean, obviously, we know that NATO doesn't care about the Ukrainians, but does it reach a point where the Zelensky government is no longer able to continue this?
Well, you've just had in the last few days a purge by Zelensky of very important figures. I think the head of the SBU, a former friend of his, has been kicked out. Some other high-ranking figures. So we're not quite sure why this is. The Americans have also just warned about Zelensky's security. Some analysts have said the Americans essentially threatened him.
Right.
So and this is increasingly, you expect to see much more repression in Ukraine. And this is all part of, we started this conversation talking about a kill list. Well, in Ukrainian society, it's basically impossible to criticize the government or to criticize the nationalists because it's so dangerous there. So you're going to see so much more repression in Ukraine, forcing people to do what the government says. I also can't tell you how many videos I've seen online of women in Ukraine standing up to these conscription officers or posting their own videos saying, you're taking our men to the front line.
Correct.
And I'm seeing increasingly angry video posts, particularly from women in Ukraine as well, and men, just saying this, we can't keep sustaining this. So you ask a good question of whether Ukraine can keep sustaining it. I think the NATO has so much control over Ukraine. I mean, NATO could change the Ukrainian government whenever it wanted. They fund and arm the Ukrainians. They basically control.
So do you think it would be correct to say that is it related to the person of Zelensky, or is it not that important whether he remains or he goes?
I don't think it's that important. I mean, Zelensky isn't an ultra-nationalist. But I mean, I actually think he's quite a decent guy, to be honest with you. Before he became president, he did a famous interview in which he said, just let the pro-Russians speak Russian. Just let them do it. Why do we have to force them not to? He did a lot of work in stopping corruption or helping to stop corruption before the Russian invasion. So I think Zelensky's quite a decent guy, a reasonably moderate guy. But he doesn't really have much power here. You've got the Americans on one side and the ultra-nationalists on the other, and he's caught in the middle, having to do whatever he's told, frankly. So you may well see more purges or maybe a change of government, but NATO is clearly determined to keep this war going on as long as possible. But as you say, there may well be a breaking point at some point in which the Ukrainians simply can't sustain it. But whether this war is going to last another few months, or Afghanistan lasted 20 years. So that's my fear.
Well, you know, I think you're right. I mean, I don't think it's going to be 20 years. It might be maybe a year or two. But the way I see it, that, you know, Russia is not crumbling. All the sanctions haven't worked. They've actually backfired on the West. Russia is doing okay. You know, it's not under pressure. You saw we recently had President Putin and President Erdogan come to Tehran for the big summit about Syria. So it doesn't seem to be that the Western policy, the Western strategy has been working against Russia. Tell us what the mood is. You're across the border. What is the mood in Russia on all this issue?
Yeah, before going to Donbass, the Russians, of course, call this a special military operation. Well, for people in Russia, this does very much feel like a special military operation on the edges of the empire, if you like. It's not really affecting Russian people all that much. Yes, the sanctions are damaging. Certainly some people who work in trade with the West, for example.
All right. So listen, Johnny, I want to conclude with going back to the West a little bit. And, you know, I want to also commend you and say thank you. You deserve some rest. You were in very difficult situations. You are now going to spend a little time resting. But before we end our conversation, let's go back to the West. We talked about the future in Ukraine. You talked about how in Russia it's not really affecting daily life. And we also talked about, you know, the idea that maybe the Europeans miscalculated. Do you feel that there is a chance, an opportunity, that there would be a movement in Western countries? Of course, each country is different. We don't want to generalize. Where you could see people, you know, starting to protest about this and trying to get this to end, because it seems it's going to have a bad effect on them, especially when it gets colder. And when, you know, they start feeling the problems in terms of prices and the effects it has on their daily life.
Well, the Russian media likes to make out that all these Western leaders are falling now with Boris Johnson, the Italian, and they like to think that it's all because of Ukraine. I think maybe some of it is. I do point out to a Russian journalist that Boris Johnson is scandal after domestic scandal, and that's the major reason he's fallen. But I think particularly when you see winter coming, and gas prices going up so much, I think you may well see a lot of people start saying, is this war really worth it? And increasingly politicians, particularly German, French, Emmanuel Macron is still on the phone to Putin all the time. Russia and Germany do have relations with Russia. So I think winter, you may well see an opportunity for European countries to say, look, we're not having any more of this. And without Russian and without French and German support, can the Americans and Brits go alone in Ukraine and arming Ukraine? I'm not sure. But I think maybe when winter comes, you may well see another opportunity, if you like, for particularly European countries to question whether their continued support of Ukraine militarily rather than pushing for peace is really the right option for the European people.
Press TV correspondent Johnny Miller, thank you so much for joining us. I know you were tired, but you took the time to have a conversation with us. Thank you very much. Get some rest, stay safe, and looking forward to more of your excellent reporting.
Thank you so much. And we're also going to open the window. It's got so hot in here. So that's the first thing I want to do. But thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Our pleasure.
So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Johnny Miller? The reality on the ground in Ukraine is very different than what is being portrayed in Western media. It is virtually impossible to rationally discuss this war and to suggest that NATO or Ukraine are partially to blame for what is happening. NATO's aggressive expansion eastwards following the collapse of the Soviet Union and the existential threat that this poses to the Russian homeland are rarely discussed. It seems that NATO was itching for a war with Russia, no matter what, and as the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, mentioned in his meeting with President Putin in Tehran, NATO would have eventually used the excuse of the Crimea to start a war with Russia. To understand this ingrained Russophobia among Western elites, we have to go back to the end of the 19th century and British imperial strategists such as Halford Mackinder, who claimed that if Britain wants to rule the world, it has to rule Eastern Europe, West Asia, and Eurasia in general. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asl zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. Stay tuned.
اون آقای ادریس حسینی که شیعه نبود.
Idris al-Husseini is a Moroccan scholar who reverted from Sunnism to Shiism. He has a book titled Al-Husayn Made Me Shia. In the preface of the book, he claims that once he was asked about the main reason for his conversion to Shia Islam. He answers, I could neglect so many details in Islam except those related to Karbala tragedy and Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. I couldn't understand why so-called Muslims dared to kill the grandson of Prophet Muhammad in the name of Islam and trample their horses on his body.
میگد این حادثه مرا مسلمان کرد شیعه کرد.
Idris al-Husseini believes that studying the tragedy of Karbala made him a Shia Muslim. In better words, this scholar was influenced by the school of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and mourning ceremonies that are held for him. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Rafi'i. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en/Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.